This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at WAEPA.org. Here's your host, Mike Causey.
Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about a subject that that hits us this time of year, taxes. And my guest is Tom O'Rourke. Tom is a very well-known estate attorney and tax lawyer in the Washington area. Has a, I guess most of your clients, Tom, are federal workers or former federal workers, correct?
Yes, sir. Quite a few of them are.
Okay, and you were with the you were with the Internal Revenue Service for a number of years as an attorney before turning to this. So you've been inside and outside, and the timing is good. And I make no bones about knowing anything about taxes. I just mailed mine off to the lady in Tennessee who does them. And I hope, you know, our joke is every year she keeps me out of jail, and that's wonderful. But you remember back during the Clinton administration, in fact, this is the way we started the column today, the Secretary of the Treasury or the nominee for the Secretary of the Treasury, which would include the head of the Internal Revenue Service, it was discovered in an audit that he had underpaid his taxes for about a three-year period by about $34,000, which in 2001 was a lot of money, still a lot of money, but there was no big problem with it. Everybody sort of, even though it was a partisan issue, people just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, yep, it's tough, it's difficult, and we all make mistakes. And, you know, some would say a $34,000 mistake by a Wall Street genius doing his own taxes would be an eyebrow raiser. But while people found it amusing, some may be embarrassing, a lot of people just accepted it because doing your taxes is so complicated. Has it gotten worse, or does it just seem that way?
Well, Mike, it seems to me to be more difficult every year because the IRS, it started out, its sole mission was to make sure people complied with the tax law. And it's been given new obligations. Seems like every time Congress meets, it comes up with some sort of a new program and places a responsibility for administering that program on the IRS. And as a result, the only way the IRS can do that is to require us to file additional information when we file our own tax return. And that does tend to significantly complicate the filing of your return.
Well, you know, somebody coming in from another planet and investigating life on Earth, I think they'd find it interesting that in the arguably the most powerful advanced country in the, on the planet, the United States, we have two agencies, the Internal Revenue Service and now the U.S. Postal Service, that literally touch everybody one way or the other. So, in some cases, both touch everybody. And yet,
Certainly true.
Yeah, well, yeah. And you know, they keep cutting back in numbers. And as you pointed out with the IRS, adding more duties to them. And it's almost as if there was a conspiracy out there to whittle down these two agencies so that somebody can privatize them, somebody can skim the gravy from the Postal Service. But it just doesn't make common sense.
Well, that seems to be the case, Mike, but I used to teach tax courses to undergraduate accounting students, and in my introductory lecture, I would always make two points. I would say, at some point during the course of this semester, somebody's going to raise their hand and say, it doesn't make sense.
Okay.
And my answer answer is going to be, doesn't have to, it's the law. And there are a lot of provisions in the law that affect the IRS that simply don't make sense, but they've got a burden of carrying out what Congress has enacted. And usually when Congress enacts a law, it's with the purest of intentions, but without an understanding of the details involved in implementing that law.
Yeah, I think at some point, and we all go through it in life, but when you say something doesn't make sense or something isn't fair, and you have to say, grow up. That is the way it is.
Yeah. That's absolutely true, and it's certainly true with taxes.
Yeah, I think I know of two people, and one I'm not sure has ever paid taxes, and the other hasn't paid taxes for some incredibly long period, like 10 years. Now, other than getting on a slow boat to somewhere, what would you suggest people like that do?
Well, I would suggest that they take steps to get in compliance. Are there people that don't file and get away with it? Yeah, there are. But I think they're relatively small and they're running a big risk. But the only way to do that is to subsist solely by only getting cash for any work you performed, and the person who's paying you must be paying you under the table, because when you hire somebody and pay them to work for you, you're supposed to report that to the IRS, you as the payor.
Yeah.
And for most people, all of you, especially right now, people are starting to think about filing their taxes. In the last month, they have all gotten W-2s and forms 1099 and all kind of forms from anybody with whom they have any financial dealings. And the only way to stay out under the radar of the IRS is not to get any of those forms to get paid and simply ignore your obligation. Do people do it? I have very little doubt. Supposedly there's a very large underground economy, and the IRS is aware of it, and it does what it can to curb it. But are there people that cheat and get away with it? Absolutely.
Yeah, it must be
that's not a course of action,
right,
I'm suggesting,
right,
to anybody.
Right, exactly. Well, and most of today's column you wrote, so I can brag on it. But I'm looking here at the first point and to the point you just made. Point number one is report all of your income. You said there's a strong likelihood IRS already knows. They've got a 10
right.
whatever from the employer, so don't mess around with a few hundred or a few thousand bucks and underreport it.
That's true. I mean, all of your listeners sometime within the month of January would have gotten a statement from whom. With any entity that where they had any kind of financial account, they certainly would have got a W-2 from their employer. They would have gotten a form 1099-R from OPM. They would have gotten forms from any bank or any mutual fund company or investment firm where they had any account. Well, everything you get, the IRS also gets. In fact, several years ago, the IRS proposed to Congress to completely eliminate the filing requirement, to make it voluntary. And they'd give you the option of letting them prepare your return. And what the IRS proposal was is they would send you a return every year, and if you agreed with it, you could simply agree and either remit any balance due or get your refund, or alternatively, you could file your own tax return and claim whatever you thought you were entitled to. So you still had the option of filing for yourself. And the reason IRS made that proposal is because they said, for most people, we already know what their items of income and deduction are, so why not relieve them of the burden of filing their tax return? That proposal went nowhere. There was a lot of opposition to it. Most of the opposition came from organizations like TurboTax and H&R Block and the American Institute of CPAs, and it simply went nowhere. But what that demonstrated to me was IRS pretty much knows what items of income and deduction you have, so don't think you're going to get away with something by failing to report that $500 dividend you may have gotten from your mutual fund company.
Well, you know, I remember that at the time, and I remember somebody, some sage, who pointed out, and he had a number, and in a case like this, you can, as we used to say in the old days, you could make up almost any number and nobody's going to argue with it. But he had a specific number of people, accountants and that sort of thing, who would be literally be put out of business if people didn't have to file. And that was the impetus, I guess, behind this. So, do you think it's a good idea, though, if in a perfect world?
I think it's a wonderful idea. Uh-huh. I mean, our tax system is designed to fund our government. Why shouldn't it be as easy as possible?
Yeah. Okay.
And I guess I'm a person who has a vested interest in having the system be as complex as possible.
Yeah. Okay.
As a matter of policy, I'm not sure it's a good idea.
Yeah.
But I'm not a policymaker,
right,
Mike.
Okay. All right. Well, Eric White, our producer, wants us to take a break here, so we will on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. Be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tom O'Rourke. He's a well-known, well-respected state attorney and tax attorney in the Washington area, and he was with the Internal Revenue Service for a number of years, and now in the business of helping people with financial planning, estate planning, and that sort of thing. And Tom, we got a question here that I think it kind of follows what we were discussing earlier when you said report all your income and whatnot. And this is from John, and he says, in today's column, one line ended, quote, likely to get a letter from them along with a bill for any tax due on the unreported income. And he says, having tried to keep up on taxes for a relative with Alzheimer's, I would have extended the statement to include the phrase, quote, and any interest and penalty due following the word due. For example, it would read, would likely get a letter from them being the IRS, along with a bill for any tax due and any interest and penalties due on the unreported income. That's probably something I dropped. Is he right?
Well, no, that's not something you dropped. It's
okay.
Something that I dropped.
Okay.
But John is absolutely right. If you fail to report income, whether because you forgot it or in the case he's dealing with, where you have somebody who isn't sure where they are or mm-hmm. who they are, it's easy to make a mistake on your taxes. And if you owe taxes and don't pay it, you will get a bill for any additional amount due. And anytime you owe an additional amount due, IRS routinely imposes interest and penalties. Now, a suggestion I would make to John is he may wish to contact the IRS. They generally will waive any penalty for reasonable cause. And I too have dealt with this on behalf of many clients. And the folks in the IRS are sympathetic. They realize that when a person gets Alzheimer's, they're not satisfying their tax liability out of any intent to avoid taxes. They just no longer have the ability to understand that they owe taxes. So in all likelihood, he could get the IRS to waive any to waive any penalties. But the IRS has very, very limited authority to waive interest. Generally, mm-hmm. if you owe taxes, they will impose interest because the law requires them to.
Yeah. Well, you know, I digress here, but when you said something about being helpful, many years ago, I had to get the help of I think they called it the Problem Resolution Group in those days.
Right.
It was sort of a separate entity, part of the IRS, and I expected a nightmare, and they couldn't have been nicer. It was as if they were my own private attorneys, and they would say, oh, you don't have to worry about that. And I said, yeah, but you guys, the IRS said this, and they said, don't worry about that, do this. And they said, they will ask you certain things. And it was as if they were really on my side. And you know, the break between church and state there was really good. And it just could not have been better service. So
yeah, I, I think your experience is very typical.
Mm-hmm.
Most people find the same thing. Nobody knows better than the IRS how complicated the tax code is, and many times people simply make mistakes.
They
it's not out of malicious intent; it's out of a misunderstanding of how the law operates.
Well, I remember calling once and got a woman, and I said, if you get a year-end bonus or something for the dumbest customer, then you just won it, because here I am.
Yeah.
And she assured me that I wasn't, and we had a good working relationship. Got another interesting question here, and this is from Kelly, and she says, I was executor of my great aunt in New York State. She did not have a will. Needless to say, I did a ton of work for the family. I was not entitled to the inheritance. I was not a first cousin and was given a check for being the executor. The check was for over $13,000, so what, if any, taxes do I owe? I was also given a separate check for reimbursements, i.e. death certificates, miscellaneous legal fees, that I paid out of my own pocket. Would I owe that as well in taxes? Thanks, Kelly.
Well, there's a couple of points there, Mike. Many times when I'm on your show, I talk about estate planning.
Yeah.
And I say if you die without a will, you don't die without an estate plan. The state has a plan for you,
yes,
and that's
right.
What happened in Kelly's case.
Yeah.
She didn't get any of her great-aunt's assets, but she did get paid for her services. Most states do allow, quote, reasonable compensation for serving as an executor. That's how Kelly got that $13,000.
Mm-hmm.
But that was designed to be payment for services, and that is taxable income. She also is obligated to report any expense reimbursement she got, but she would be able to deduct those expenses when she files her return. So the good news is she got paid for her services. The bad news, she's got to pay taxes on it. She will have to report the reimbursement, but she'll be able to claim an offsetting deduction.
You know, I would think I've never been through anything like that, and anybody who knows me would not put me in a position that I had any responsibility for anything financial. But I just can't imagine doing it. And this is a case where if you can go to a professional and get a power of attorney and find out what you need to do, because you do have an estate probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's a common misconception is naming somebody an executor is you're bestowing an honor on them.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, and they deserve to be paid for it, and all state laws recognize that.
Yeah. Well, I know, and the last time we did a show on that subject, we both discussed situations. You've seen it professionally. I've seen it from friends and whatnot. But you make one of the brothers, one of the siblings, one of the children, the executor, and it can split up a family. It's just a terrible business, a terrible time of life.
I've seen that happen on frequent occasions.
Okay. Now, I remember looking at that next point in today's column. By the way, Tom wrote the vast majority of it. Back when I was with the Washington Post, young reporter, a lot of us did freelance work. We'd write for other publications, and sometimes under our own name, sometimes no byline or something else. But I remember a lot of people, and we were very modestly paid and all that, but a lot of people claimed home offices when they were working.
Boy, that used to be very common.
Well, you know, I remember talking to a tax attorney one time, or IRS guy, and he said, and again, this was back in the day, but he said, if you want to get audited, claim a home office, because he said it was sort of a red flag.
True.
Is that true?
That's true. For many years, teachers were told that it's well known that if you're a teacher, you many times do a lot of work outside
sure.
the classroom. And they were under the impression, well, if I have to do this work at home, I should be able to claim a home office deduction.
Mm.
And they did. Or the example you give where you did some freelance work.
Yeah.
But the requirements for claiming a home office deduction were very clear. You had to use the home regularly. In other words, not just on a one-off occasion, but on a frequent basis. And more important, you had to use it exclusively. In other words, you couldn't use that space in your home for anything other than an office. And then the final requirement is you had to do it for the convenience of your employer, not your personal convenience. And virtually anybody who had a job and had an office wasn't using a home office for the convenience of their employer. They were doing it for their own benefit. But that issue went away a couple years ago when Congress completely eliminated the category of deductions called a miscellaneous itemized deductions. That was eliminated as part of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which became effective on January 1st of 2018. So now you simply are not entitled to a home office deduction unless you have your own independent business and you work from home. So for most individual taxpayers, and this is particularly important now when virtually or a very large number of federal employees, the only office they have is their office at home.
Yeah.
Maybe their kitchen table or maybe their basement, but they can't go into the office. And they're saying, look, I'm using my electricity, I'm using my space. Why can't I claim a home office deduction? And the answer is very simple, because the law says you can't.
Yeah.
Don't argue with the logic of it. You simply can't do it. And so home office deduction, you're right, is something that for many years was some people could be entitled to it, but the circumstances establishing your entitlement were very limited, and it was a big audit argument.
Yeah, and go ahead, I'm sorry.
Now, if you claim it, it's simply going to be disallowed.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. Yeah, because I remember people who lived extremely modestly. You know, we all had one-bedroom apartments, if that, and they would claim the den, which didn't exist, was their office. And also there was a problem with many people got free magazines, you know, complimentary copies of things going to the
right.
News media, and they would claim that it was a paid subscription. So, I mean, clearly wrong, but the whole concept, you can see how the IRS and others would look at this as sort of a shady way to do business.
Yeah, and that's how a lot of people ended up, number one, getting audited, and number two, getting in trouble.
Okay, I want to ask you about deductions, but we need to take a break here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM, and then we'll be right back. Hey, Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. Talking with Tom O'Rourke. He's a estate and tax attorney in the Washington area. And today's column, I hope you'll take a look at it. And I could say that because Tom wrote most of it, but it's called Taxes Can Trip Up a Treasury Secretary, Too. And the reason I did that, hopefully, you know, with the purpose of the headline is to catch eyeballs, but without exaggerating something. But President Clinton nominated someone to be Secretary of the Treasury, and that which would make him the head of the Internal Revenue Service, too. And as a Wall Street brilliant person, an attorney, and all that, financial expert and all that. And they found out that he had done his own taxes, and he had messed them up to the point of $34,000 for a three-year period. And in 2001, that was a considerable sum of money. But the point is, A, it's eye-catching. It happens to be true, but it also shows it can happen to anyone. You don't need to be an expert or an amateur like me to make a mistake. In fact, the experts make them all the time. Tom, we're talking the last segment about deductions and those kinds of things, and I know many people are unclear, and I didn't realize until you mentioned it again that so many of these changes took place in 2017. I guess they were effective for most people 2018. But a lot of deductions just simply went away. And I love the fact you said that don't argue with the logic of something. That's the way it is. That's the law. You can work to change it. But when the ship is sinking, don't ask why somebody didn't have more life preservers or plugs in the thing. When you're talking about legitimate deductions, now, for an awful lot of people, many of the things that we might have deducted have just gone away, correct?
That's true. And the one whole category of miscellaneous itemized deductions was completely eliminated. And we talked about home office, but it included other things like union dues or professional dues, tax preparation fees, financial advisory fees. All of those things used to be deductible under the heading miscellaneous itemized deductions, but they're all gone. And the things that are now permissibly deductible are really fairly limited. And at least one of the purposes of the 2017 Tax Act was to make it simpler to file. And the way Congress did that was, number one, they limited the category of items that could be deductible, and it significantly increased the standard deduction. And I read an article in the Wall Street Journal near the end of the year, and it said for the year 2019, the one you filed your tax return for last year, 90% of all taxpayers claimed a standard deduction. So that's good from a number of points.
Yeah.
Number one, it makes it easier to prepare your return. And number two, it alleviates your obligation to keep records, because the standard deduction is the amount that IRS says you're automatically entitled to. So the 2017 Tax Act, at least in part, was done to simplify the preparation of your return, and I think that's been true. But most folks I've talked to that live in the D.C. area aren't happy with it, because although it may have simplified filing your return, it may have increased your tax obligation. One of the main reasons for that is the starting in 2018, the maximum deduction you are entitled to claim for paying state and local taxes is $10,000 per return. And if you have a married couple that works in a major metropolitan area, there's a strong likelihood that they pay substantially more than $10,000 in income taxes alone to their state and local government. But you can only deduct $10,000 of the amount you paid. And for most folks that I've dealt with, the two biggest itemized deductions they were able to claim would be their state and local taxes that they paid, income taxes, real estate taxes, personal property taxes, and that's now limited to $10,000. And the deduction on their home mortgage loan, because many times homes are very expensive, and mortgage is a major expense that many people incur. Now, as a result of the 2017 Tax Act, a big part of those deductions goes away. So for many folks, they may find now, according to the Wall Street Journal, about 90% of all taxpayers will find that they'll pay the least amount of tax if they claim a standard deduction. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, that pretty much eliminates the possibility for audit, assuming you properly report all income you received.
Yeah, this looking at the information you have in today's column, today's federal report, it really hits my sweet spot, because the state and local tax, the mortgage tax, is $10,000 maximum, and mine would be about $8,000. And then the home mortgage interest. I guess in olden times, if you had a $5.6 million home, you could deduct a mortgage thing on that, and now it's limited to $750,000. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Starting in 2018, you can still deduct mortgage interest, but only on a loan of up to $750,000. Now, for most folks, they have a mortgage of less than $750,000. But there are folks that may have two homes. They may have a beach house, and they may have their primary residence. But the amount of mortgage interest you can deduct is limited to $750,000. And the other category of deduction that for many years was widely used was interest on a home equity loan. You and I are old enough to remember back in the good old days when you could deduct all kinds of interest. You deduct interest on a car loan, credit card interest. All that went away in 1986, and the only types of interest deductible starting in 1986 were interest on a home mortgage or interest on a home equity loan. So a lot of people would use interest on a home equity loan to do things like pay off credit card debt or to buy a new car because it was fully deductible. But starting in 2018, you can now only deduct interest on a home equity loan if the proceeds of the loan are used to maintain or improve your home. In other words, you put in a new kitchen, you put on a new roof, you finish your basement. That's so your ability to deduct all of your home equity interest is no longer fully deductible.
Yeah, okay. And that benefits people of more modest means too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I know starting in 1986, anytime I would buy a new car, rather than using the dealer's financing, unless it was they gave me a 0% loan, I would draw down on my home equity loan to do that. And I did it simply, well, number one, interest on a home equity loan is usually lower than most other types of debt because it's secured by your home. So I paid a lower interest rate, but I was also able to deduct it. Well, not anymore. That's not part of the law now.
Well, so, you know, looking at the tax reforms in D.C., everything is reform. So reform gives it a good cast. But the 86 reform and then the 2017, you know, so many people characterize any tax changes as benefiting the rich. And I'm sure the rich make out very well. But those two, at least in these provisions, really seem to help ordinary taxpayers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it certainly did. One of the really good thing about the 2018 tax or 2017 law that became effective in 2018 was it increased the standard deduction significantly. Now, this year, 2021, a married couple gets a standard deduction of $25,000. So if all your itemized deductions are less than that, you're going to pay a lower tax liability by claiming a standard deduction. So it did help the average Joe in that respect, and it made it easier to prepare their tax return. So, but there still are plenty of other opportunities for people to make mistakes.
Okay. Now, one of the things you mentioned in the column are charitable contributions, and I think a lot of people, or myself included, are confused about that because at one point it was possible to contribute an awful lot of money to charity and get a deduction on it, and many wealthy people, philanthropic people, did that.
There still is a charitable contribution deduction in the tax return. And unlike mortgage interest and state and local taxes, any mortgage interest you pay or any state and local taxes you pay are reported to the IRS. If you have a mortgage, your mortgage lender reports how much interest and taxes you pay. If you have on your salary, your income taxes are reported directly by your employer. But when you make a charitable contribution, nobody reports how much that contribution was directly to the IRS. So when you contribute $1,000 to your church or to your university, IRS has no record of that. They're depending on your honesty. And sometimes people get a little tempted to exaggerate, and that's particularly true for people who donate things other than cash.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, it's easy to value cash.
Yeah.
It's not quite so easy to value, you know, those used shirts you donated to Goodwill. And I will never forget, back in the days when I worked for IRS, I happened to get assigned a case of a gentleman who had played for the Redskins. And he valued a suit that he donated to Goodwill at something like $700. And I said to him, I said, sir, that's more than the suit cost when it was brand new. He said, yeah, but it became worth more because I wore it.
Perfect argument.
Well, when Goodwill put it for sale, they didn't say Mr. Redskin
that's right.
wore this suit. So
that's right. Well,
but anyway, people do tend to get a little carried away sometimes.
Well, there's something similar to that happened when the wife of a former president was donating his shorts to Goodwill or
yes.
something, and that value added. I'll leave it
right.
at that. And Eric wants us to take a break here, so we'll do that here on FederalNewsNetwork.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tom O'Rourke. He's a state attorney and tax attorney in the Washington area and worked for the IRS for many years. And some very interesting points. I hope you'll take a look at today's Federal Report column, not because it's got a byline on it, but Tom wrote most of it. And some really good ... tax information there that can help you out. Tom, I know one thing, and we talk about different tax changes and, quote, simplifications and all that. But I remember when I first started working, you know, getting a check and deductions and whatnot, there was a local drugstore here. I think it was called Dart Drug. Maybe it doesn't exist anymore. But they would do your taxes for $10 or something like that. And mine weren't particularly complicated. But I saw this line item which said you can file later if you want to. And I thought, well, that's why not? It's a great idea. And so I waited until, instead of April, I waited until October for no good reason, just to do it. And I got a little penalty because I didn't understand that you can defer filing. And maybe this has changed, but you could defer filing, but you had to pay the taxes on time. Is that still the case?
Yes, sir. It certainly is.
Okay.
As I'm sure most of your listeners know, the filing date for income taxes is April 15th. It was backed up till July for last year only. That was a one-time only thing. Your tax return this year is due on April 15th. And if for whatever reason you just can't get everything filed, you can get an automatic extension until October 15th. All you have to do is ask for it. But you're obligated to pay any estimated tax you might owe. So let's say you can't get everything together by April 15th and you figure, well, I'm going to owe about $1,000. You can get an automatic extension to file, but you're supposed to pay that $1,000 you're going to owe at the time you file the request for the extension. And if you don't, you're going to be penalized. You're going to pay a failure to file penalty, which is a 0.5% per month for each month that you fail to pay it. So, yeah, you can get the extension, but you're still obligated to pay by the due date.
Yeah, yeah. I just saw the upside of it, not the reality side of it. And you recommend, too, that people file electronically. Obvious, I guess, but...
I do, because you know what's happened in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Many of your listeners haven't been near their office in close to a year. Well, IRS has many people working remotely also.
Yeah.
But unlike you, the IRS gets hundreds of thousands of pieces of mail every day,
mm-hmm.
and are not as many, and there may not be any people there processing that mail. If you file electronically, IRS, like everybody else, has access to their computer, and they're still performing their mission, but they just aren't doing it in person. So if you file electronically, everything you file goes electronically into their system. Now, if you're entitled to a refund, and you'll get your refund a heck of a lot quicker if you file your return electronically. My experience has been people generally get a refund if you file electronically and ask them to directly deposit that refund in your bank account, you usually get it within 2 to 4 weeks of the time you file. If you file by mail, good luck. It may take 2 to 6 weeks for somebody to open your return.
Yeah. Yeah, that's 2 to 4 weeks is warp speed. Well, and I guess, obviously, the worst thing to do is to not file. You know,
absolutely. Most people that I've dealt with that have gotten in big trouble, it's been because they haven't filed. Many times they may have what they think is a very good reason. They simply don't have the money. They're busy taking care of an elderly parent. They're sick, whatever. So they just don't file. And if you don't file, there's a failure to file penalty of 5% per month up to a maximum of 25%. So if you fail to file and you owe $1,000 within 6 months, your liability is going to increase by 25%. So that's just out-of-pocket money you're going to have to pay. And, oh, by the way, failing to file your return is also a criminal offense. Now, generally, when people just inadvertently fail to file or have any kind of an excuse at all, IRS doesn't prosecute them. But they do expect you to pay, and they will hold you liable for the additional amount. But that's where I've seen people get into a lot of trouble. They get into a financial bind. April 15th is coming due. They don't have the money, so they don't file. Well, go ahead and file anyway. Truthfully report your income and propose to pay your liability off.
Tom,
and in IRS.
Excuse me, one second. We're running close to time here, but I want to be sure to tell people how to reach you.
The best way, Mike, is by email. My email address is T-O-R-O-U-R-K-E, O-R-O-U-R-K-E, at Miles Stockbridge, MilesStockbridge.com.
Okay. And again, as we pointed out early in the show, the Internal Revenue Service really genuinely wants to work with you. And I know a number of cases of people who are on payment plans, and the IRS has been very good to them, and they just want to get it settled. They're not looking to put you in jail. So remember, April 15th, you can defer it, but you still have to pay the taxes. We'll hope to see you all here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. So stay safe. Have a good week. Thank you, Eric White. We'll see you all here next Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You've been listening to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at weepa.org.